Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section.
Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I am pleased to bring to you Psalm 53, Tila Nun Gimel. Psalm 53 is nearly identical to Psalm 14, Tila Yudalit. So we'll be able to learn essentially two chapters at once today and understand each one perhaps better, not only by making comparisons, but by contrasting them as well. I ask the OU to include a PDF file where I highlight the differences between the two Psalms side by side. As I compare and contrast, it will make it easier for you to understand if you're looking at the diagram. Now, don't be concerned that there are two identical psalms in a single book of Tehillim, and don't overwork too much to find out which is quote-unquote the original psalm. It could be 53 is the original, it could be 14 is the original. It could be that both borrow from an earlier unrecorded psalm. The most famous example of this is David's borrowing from Chana for his Psalm 113, which is said during the Hallel services, which is read on most holidays in traditional prayers. Chana, the mother of Shmuel, in chapter 2 of 1 Samuel sings, Mekim me'afar dal me'ashpot yarim evyon lehoshiv im nedivim v'chisei chavod yanchileim. And David, some years later, sings, Mekimi me'afar dal me'ashpot yarim evyon lehoshiv im nedivim im nedive amo. Imitation is surely the sincerest form of flattery. We've already seen how in Psalm 70, the entire psalm is nearly identical to the last few lines of Psalm 40, and there are other examples of this borrowing as well. As we will see, it's where these psalms differ, which is much more interesting and significant than the fact that they are in other ways identical. The first contrast, albeit not the most significant of contrast, is the replacement of Psalm 14's Hashem, or Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the Adnut name of God, with Elohim in Psalm 53 as the name of God. This follows the trend of using Elohim as the predominant name of God in the second book of Psalms. The second book of Psalms are the Psalms 42 to 72. In the 30 Psalms of Book 2, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the Adonai name of God, shows up only 30 times. In Book 1, the same name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, appears 250 times. Elohim, as a name of God, on the other hand, shows up in Book 2 139 times, which doesn't include variations like Eloheinu, Elohai, and the like, but it appears only 16 times in Book 1. Actually, similar statistics can be tracked all the way through Psalm 83. The significance I won't speculate on. It could be different moods of the author, different spiritual goals of the author. Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the Adnut name of God, tends to be more personal and covenantal, as well as really describing his eternality, because the eternality is built into the very name. Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei really is Hayah Hoveh Yehiyeh, I was, I am, and I will be. Elohim, on the other hand, tends to describe a more universalistic aspect of God, especially his justice, that is, where God applies not only to the Jewish nation, but to all nations as well. In comparing our two psalms, less interesting than noticing how the four Yud-Kei-Vav-Keis of Psalm 14 become four Elohims, or Elohims, in Psalm 53, is the one time where both psalms read Elohim. That is, it's not Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei in the first one and Elohim in the second one. They're both Elohim. This happens in the first line of the poem and is therefore significant. But first, let's read the inscription. Lamnatzeach al machalat maskil David. For the maestro on the machalat, a maskil by David. Machalat can mean dancers or it could mean flutes. But again, there's no way to know for sure now what David was referring to. Maskil may be a psalm of instruction or wisdom, but also may simply indicate the tune or the meter of the song. However, in this case, we actually find in the body of the poem the word maskil to indicate a wise person is used as well. So it could be that that's the meaning here in the inscription as well. Also note that we can see now by comparing these two psalms that while David, Lid David, may mean that David wrote it, it could be that it was a psalm that belonged to David but was then modified by a later psalmist. Amar Naval Blibo Ein Elohim. A worthless person says there is no Elohim. Because the word Elohim here appears both in Psalm 14 and in Psalm 53, the meaning is almost certainly not God, since it would have been switched to Yudke Vavke, the Adnut name in Psalm 14, if it did mean God. Keep in mind that the idea of philosophical atheism, Ein Elohim, there is no God, was unheard of in the ancient Near East. A worldview that did not recognize some supernatural force or forces is simply an anachronism in the world of the Bible. What isn't an anachronism, however, is functional atheism, i.e., there's a God, but so what? I can do whatever I want. Or, there's a God, but either he won't see, or he won't care, or he can't do anything about it. That's functional atheism. Moreover, we notice that the use of the word Elohim is different in early places in the Bible, especially with dealing with people who did not recognize God as a single God, a monotheism. For instance, when Abraham tells Avimelech, the king of Gerar, in Genesis, that he was sure that there was no fear of Elohim in Avimelech's place, the sense is not that people didn't fear God himself, but that the fear that requires moral behavior to be observed was lacking. This is also how it's used by Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, at the end of Genesis. In this case, the sense of Elohim is closer to the word judges. There is no fear of judges than it means there is no fear of God. But it's in the abstract sense. So the meaning really is the worthless person says that there is no need for morality. I could do whatever I want. Hishchitu v'hitivu avel ein osei tov. They cause destruction. That is, these worthless, these rotten people cause corruption, resulting in injustice. They do no good. Ein osei tov. This is as opposed to God-fearing people who are sur merav asei tov. They do good, as we were instructed in Psalm 34 and 37 alike. Naval may come from the word carcass. It could also mean to rot and something like that. It probably does not refer specifically to the character of Naval, the husband of Abigail, who confronted David and refused to give David his due after David's men protected Naval's riches. Naval, in fact, was probably called Naval because of his actions, not because his parents actually called him Naval, which would be a pretty strange name to give your son, you know, rotting corpse. Similar to names that are probably given because of the type of person. We have The Rock, we have Hulk Hogan, we have the singer formerly known as Prince and now known again as Prince. And more seriously, we have our father Yisrael, whose name was changed to Yisrael from Jacob. We also have Tzafnat Paneach, whose name was given to him by Pharaoh, who used to be called Joseph. That is, the name is significant of the person's actions and not necessarily the birth name. The only other significant contrast is that Psalm 14 uses the word Alilah rather than Avel here, which is stronger here. Avel is much stronger, but the sense is the same, and therefore it's really not too significant of a contrast. Elohim Mishamayim Mishkif al Bnei Adam Lirot Hayesh Maskil Doresh et Elohim. God looks down from the heavens on the people to see if there is a man of wisdom, to see if there is a man who searches out God. Doresh is used to describe the process of looking for answers to problems from God, either by going to a prophet or to the priest at the temple. Jeremiah actually was not a real big fan of this kind of behavior, but Ezra, the high priest, was a fan of this behavior. That's all I can really say about this very interesting subject of looking for answers from God, what is referred to outside of the Jewish world as searching for an oracle. Otherwise, if I go any deeper, I'll really be outside the scope of this psalm. However, there is no question that our psalmist did feel that looking for answers for God is a virtue. It was a way of finding out how one should behave appropriately and morally. So God looks for this person of virtue, but kulo sag yachdav ne'elachu ein osei tov ein gam echad. All of them retreat, i.e. they retreat by saying there is no Elohim. They are altogether corrupt. There are none that do good, not even one. A few notes on the difficult Hebrew of this verse. I translated sag from the root nasog, to retreat, which is very close to the word sur, to draw away, which appears in the matching Psalm 14. That is, here it says sag, and in Psalm 14 in the same place it says sur. It should be noticed that the gimel in biblical times was very guttural, close in fact to the resh, which it's switched with in the other psalm, which is preserved actually in modern Arabic, which is why Aza is called Gaza. That's why we have the Gaza Strip when we would think it should be the Aza Strip, because the gimel was so guttural it could barely be heard. It's also possible that the word sag means dregs and dross from the word sigim, which are the dregs or impurities found at the bottom of wine. And this actually is a nice match to the other difficult word, alach, which in Hebrew is retained only twice, but in Arabic it's used as a verb to describe the spoiling of milk. So it kind of fits into the second interpretation. But either way, the idea is that all he finds is rot, or people who have no value. God could find nothing good amongst this Nivalim. In fact, that's why they're called Nivalim. And who they exactly are will now be resolved in the next verse to some extent. Halo yadu poale aven ochle ami achlu lechem Elohim lo karau. The hey that opens this difficult verse tells us that there's a question, but it's not entirely clear what the question is, and it's not entirely clear what it means, ochlu lechem, they ate bread. But I will try it this way. Didn't the evildoers, when they ate my nation as if they were eating bread, did they not know that they did not call to God? The Naval seems to be the enemies of Israel, physical enemies, like warring armies, who attacked Israel with neither mercy nor compassion, eating them like bread, but without looking to God to say if, when, and how much they should do in their war against Israel. This kind of approach in the Bible is similar to the case of Ashur's king Sennacherib, who on one hand, according to Isaiah, is called on to make war against Israel because of Israel's bad behavior. But then he, Sennacherib, goes overboard and becomes haughty and destroys Israel far too much, and therefore he gets punished. That's the same situation that happens with the Pharaoh of Egypt in the book of Exodus, who was supposed to punish Israel for a little bit of her sins in exile, but went way overboard and therefore required far greater punishment. In my translation, I'm equating the phrase Elohim lo karau, they did not call God, with the previous verse where it says that God did not find anybody searching for God, Doresh Elohim. Sham, so it was there in the battlefield. Sham pachadu pachad, lo haya pachad, ki Elohim pizer atzmot chonach, hevishota ki Elohim me'asam. There they feared a fear when there was nothing to fear, because God has scattered the bones of the encampment, chonach probably from the word machaneh, an encampment. You, i.e. God, have put them to shame. Indeed, God has found them disgusting. That is, he has rejected them. A grammatical note here, pachadu pachad is a nice construct. It's called a cognate accusative, which is a fancy way of saying that the verb matches the direct object. They feared a fear. This creates an emphasis in Biblical Hebrew, a stress on the idea. It's found in different expressions such as Vayishritu Sheretz and the Nile teemed with teeming things, and also Vayatsev Matseva, and he erected an altar. It often doesn't work in English, but it works very nicely in Hebrew, among many other examples of this. Also note the idea that in war, sometimes it's not that the enemy is outnumbered, it's that fear sets into the enemy camp. Just to tell a quick personal story, when I was in the Israeli army, I was on duty one night in the Golan Heights up in northern Israel, and I had the siren right next to me, and if you were worried that there was a war going on, you would hit the siren, everybody would wake up, and they would run to their tanks. I was in the tank corps. So I'm looking at this mountain, which is right on the Syrian border, and all of a sudden there's a fire on top of the mountain. And it's the middle of the night, and nobody is awake but me, and it's really very scary, because I'm in the middle of, well, I'm not in enemy territory, but I'm maybe 2 miles away from enemy territory, and all of a sudden I see the outline of this great mountain with fire surrounding it. The fire spreads and spreads. My hand is on the siren. I'm about to essentially wake up the entire forces of the Golan Heights, and then the moon poked out from behind the mountain, and I saw that all of the light wasn't coming from fire, but it was coming from the moon's light that was diffuse in the clouds that were behind this mountain.
Well, in the end, I didn't sound the alarm, but my fear of being all alone in the middle of the night on the Golan Heights, 2 miles away from the enemy, nearly caused a regional conflict between Syria and Israel. So there's a good example of fear which sets upon you in a war, which can cause enemies to lose even when there's really nothing to fear and nothing to lose in front of.
Continuing on with the psalm. Now, if you look at the comparison chart, you can see that Psalm 14 and Psalm 53 have now taken two very divergent paths. And that is because while the enemy here is the enemies of Israel in war, external enemies, in Psalm 14, which uses the same language or similar language, the Naval, the Ein Oseh Tov, is referring to an internal enemy inside of Israel. This is the person who causes shame to come to the poor and the downtrodden, those who reject moral norms, which are as much a part of Jewish theology and law as are the belief in God and keeping the Sabbath. So where here God causes shame on the enemy, in Psalm 14 the same word is used to shame, but the shame is brought on the downtrodden by these worthless people. And where in our psalm we have the word me'asam, meaning God rejects them, the external enemies, there in Psalm 14, a similar sounding word is used, machsehu, meaning God protects them, i.e. the oppressed. So the Psalms, beginning with the same or similar word in language, almost identical, have now diverged. But by continuing to use same or similar words, but the opposite, the Psalms have become a beautiful mirror image of each other, both conceptually as well as poetically. Finally, we return to the final verse, which in our Psalm hopes for the enemy to be routed and captives to be returned and the rejuvenated armies of Zion to take advantage of God's anger with this worthless nation and army. Mi teim etzion yeshuot Yisrael b'shuv Elohim shavut amo yagel Yaakov yismach Yisrael. If only the salvation of Israel would come from Zion as God returns the exiles of his nation, then Jacob would rejoice and then Israel would be happy. But how this national cry fits into the theme of Psalm 14, with that psalm's focus on internal lack of justice and morals, I'll leave that for you to decide when you learn Psalm 14. Finally, I'd like to say that it now being the 4th of January 2009, and 2 days before Asara B'Tevet, I should note that, as you're all probably aware of, at least on this particular date, Israel is at war with Gaza. Its enemies are definitely afoot, and we can only hope that Zion will come out of that salvation will come out of Zion. Ki mi teim etzion yeshuot Yisrael b'shuv Elohim b'shuvot amo, and that he returns the exiles, or in this case, the captives of his nation, and that would be Gilad Shalit. Then Jacob will rejoice, and then Israel will be happy. So let's hope that this prayer is meaningful not only to David who wrote it, but to us in modern times as well.